The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the programme. It's 3 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 26th of June, 2026. Our Friday panel joining us very shortly to discuss some of the big issues making the headlines and made their own headlines as well, I suppose. We want you involved in the conversation, of course. 086 6025000 is the WhatsApp and the text number. 086 6025000. Give us a call if you prefer on 074 91 25000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. Just to remind you, you can watch this programme if you wish on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, across all of your devices, including your TV. And we're across Facebook as well. Right, we are waiting on former councillor Nicholas Crossan to join us. He will be with us shortly. I want to say good morning first, though, to Councillor Dakota McMenamin, Sinn Féin councillor in the Lifford Stranorlar MD. Good morning.
Good morning, Greg, and good morning to all your listeners.
Yes, indeed. And Dr. Joe Kelly's a historian as well. Good morning to you, Dr. Joe.
My Jean Wygod, Greg, is the Loch Déistíochta. Good morning to yourself and all listening in Highland Radio.
Great to see you all. Quick one, weather overnight. Have you seen anything like that, Joe? What was it like where you are?
Ah, yeah, I have.
No, you haven't.
I have. Many. Maybe a wee bit older than you now, but no, I've seen it in before. It was spectacular, the lightning watching, and I live beside the sea in this long vista of the sky, and it was just lovely to watch the colours. And but the rain was quite torrential where I was, very, very heavy. Mm. But no, I've been abroad as well, and I've seen thunderstorms.
I mean, more close at home. Dakota, what about you?
Yeah, it was crazy. I definitely hadn't seen anything like that in my lifetime. So it was great looking out at it. Yeah, it was crazy. Mm.
I see, Joe, there's people actively out trying to just sort of counter the warnings that are out there about the weather, you know, going, oh, well, you know, the weather was like this in the 1900s and, you know, they've changed the 27 from yellow to red and you're just trying to scare people and it's just the weather and just get on with it. Where do you sit in that?
Oh, I'm very sceptical of a lot of what we've been fed, and you know that that's the way I've always been. You know, I always say when someone says something to me, did you hear it on RT or is it the truth? I no longer believe what I hear or what I see. And a lot of that is because, you know, the person that pays the piper calls the tune, and research has shown that 94% of research documents come up with the conclusions that those that pay them to bring up that conclusion will come to. So if you see all the, for example, the global warming, I mean, I personally am very sceptical of that. I'm very big into the environment. But if you come to Clohanilly and look at Muckies, the top of Muckies, there's a stain mark, like a coffee mark on a cup at night, going across the top of the mountain where the snow had packed up to there 35,000 years ago. And that stain mark is still there. And the question I often ask people is, well, how did that snow and ice that was that high up on Muckies melt?
But you are living in a part of the world that's least affected by climate change at the moment. You go to, you know, parts of India, Africa, elsewhere, whereby these places are almost becoming uninhabitable. That we're not seeing weather events, we're seeing a literal shift in climate. You speak to fishermen, they will tell you that the water doesn't settle when it used to settle. Lobsters don't fish like they used to fish. You know, they're seeing changes over generations. Things are incredibly different, you know. So we could have gone through four or five climate cycles since that staining on the top of Muckish occurred.
Yeah, that's my point. Climate change, and if you notice, it's no longer called global warming. They've changed the narrative again. Climate change is a reality. I mean,
Dakota? Greg, oh, Greg? Yeah, I don't know who you're talking to. Greg, go on ahead, yeah.
Greg, not Nicholas would be on well, but I think that when you come to the understanding of the science of the Earth, just for example, how we rotate around the sun, we don't actually rotate exactly in a circle or even an oval shape around the sun 365 days a year. That is, we think we can control science, we can think we can control our environment, we think we can control solar flares. Global temperature changes are a reality in humanity since the beginning of
Dakota, what do you think when you hear that? Because, I mean, Joe is, he could be a TD. He could be sitting on an environment panel on the Dáil. He could be making decisions that affect, you know, the future of your children, my children, whatever it might be. Like, do you agree with Dr. Joe, or do you sort of think it's maybe quite unfortunate that he perhaps doesn't see what the scientists or some scientists are saying?
Yeah, I don't think I would fully agree now. I do like to believe in the science, and I do think it is a real thing that is happening. And I do think what we are doing, like, we have evolved so much between technology and everything, that it's bound to have some type of an impact. So I do think there is a lot of man-made causes here.
Well, the question I would ask there, Dakota, if you wouldn't mind, do you know how many particles of carbon per million that's in the atmosphere now? People talk about global warming.
Yes, but what we can do is trace from industrialization, Joe, and things have sped up really quite quickly since then.
The point is that there's about 400 particles per million. If that was to half in the morning, we would all be dead. Carbon is necessary for our human existence. It's in everything. That's the first thing. The second thing is it has been proven, and you can go into Google and search this, the world has never been greener because of the higher carbon rate.
Yes, but that depends on where you are. You should get on a plane maybe and go to some of these parts of the world now that are completely uninhabitable.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you that there's a change in the climate. That's not my issue. And I'm not having that issue with Dakota either. But my point is the way that researchers and government policy, they're putting the blame on human beings and our existence. Mm. And they're using tax, carbon tax, as an excuse to tax us for our rain last night and for our lightning. This is plays into the government's hands and the EU and the other UN and everybody else. Let's blame human activity for the change in climate. What I'm arguing is there is a change of climate. And what you're saying is correct, Greg, in the sense that there are parts of the world becoming uninhabitable. That is a reality. I'm not denying that. But what I am criticising, and what I do really doubt, is the science that has been given to us.
So you are of the view, then, are you, that human activity is not accelerating the melting of the ice caps and what have you? You're saying what we're doing and how we're living our lives is not impacting on things like that?
We contribute to that's what I'm saying. Yeah, but the science is there. 90% of the carbon emissions is not human. It's caused by volcanoes and other natural effects that are happening every day in the world. It's not human. And if we think that we can stop carbon increase by our own human activity, it's like you're as well to go down to the pier there in Buncrana or in Rathmullen with a pitchfork and try to hold the tide out. It's a ridiculous science that has been presented to us with regards to the taxation of carbon. Human beings are contributing, there's no doubt about that, to carbon.
But you're talking, I don't want to get into this conversation because I'm going to come across as something I'm not here either, but there's a natural carbon cycle.
Yes.
That's what you're talking about.
Yes.
Humans are disrupting that natural carbon cycle.
By a small...
But that is why we're still in existence. That's why we're seeing tiny little increases in temperature. But those tiny little increases in temperature are tiny little disruption to the natural carbon cycle certainly has to be accelerating what we're seeing.
Well, I would disagree with you with the tiny increase of temperatures. The temperatures, they estimate, are increasing by about 1.5 to 2%. That is a massive increase on an average.
Since industrialization, we have increased, the carbon in the atmosphere, atmospheric CO2, by 54%. So you're saying it's a dicky-bicky-dicky-wicky. 54% is blooming significant. Since
human contribution to the carbon, and you can Google this, AI it, human contribution to the carbon footprint is minimal
comparing to the natural.
You're looking at the 5 or 10% that the human beings are putting in, ignoring the 90% that nature itself is putting into the atmosphere.
Okay, well, listen, we have, since industrialization, we have increased the particles per million by 54%.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but that 54% particles per million is minuscule when you compare to the natural increase in carbon from natural seismic movement.
So why did all this natural seismic movement happen to begin at the start of industrialization?
It's always been there. I mean,
why did the dinosaurs disappear? I'm going to sound like right now, well, I'm going to start gluing myself to the N56, and I'm not going to do that, but... There's also statistics that are there. Right, come here. Let's bring a bit of sense into this situation. Nicholas Crossan is the only person we could get.
just to catch you up,
we were talking in the context of the weather yesterday, and then I knew what I was getting into when I asked Dr. Kelly about climate change. But anyway, go on.
Just to give it, I was reading a couple of weeks back, England contribute about roughly 1% to the carbon in the world, 1%. So the minister says if we cut ours by 0.5%, 50%, if we cut our emissions by 50% in the next 20 years, what difference would that make to the world? Now, I didn't know about the natural thing that Joe was talking about, but, you know, or probably our input, like Ireland, they're opening two electric stations and our coal-fired electric stations in China every day. And I mean, like, but we're doing, since we come on air, probably they've burned more carbon in China than we will do in the next year. But that's the way it goes.
There was a debate about posters, election posters, which we've discussed on this program.
Oh, terrible altogether. But
in terms of their contribution to the environment, and they've calculated now that a viral tweet is like the equivalent to 200 cars on the road for a year because of the data centers. And listen, anyway, I get where you're coming from. No, but it's crazy. Right, now, we've seen two massive political events in Dublin recently. First, the Sinn Féin bill to scrap the three-day abortion waiting period passed because the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste voted for it, despite a massive rebellion where the majority of their own Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael backbenchers voted against it. Now, up to 20 Fianna Fáil backbenchers have signed a letter rebelling against the leadership plans to scrap the triple lock neutrality protection, as some people frame it. Is the government leadership completely out of step with its own backbenchers and party grassroots on these fundamental social and constitutional issues? I'll go to you because you've just joined us, Nicholas. Is the leadership of the government out of step with the public and its own members, I wonder?
No, the leadership is not out of step. It has always been like that. As we say that we do live in a democracy, but I've stated for years that political parties are really a dictatorship because it comes down from the top. So whatever the leader says goes. And while party members can vote against, for the example, the three-day wait rule on the abortion or the triple lock is coming up. If you count up the opposition, we can then, to suit rural TDs, the votes were counted as the South Dem, Sinn Féin, Labour, left wings. So the votes was counted. And that left a free vote for the rural Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael TDs. You see, maybe I'm being a bit cynical here, Greg, but I think if somebody has a big enough grievance against something, which is the abortion issue or the triple lock, two very, very important things that we're not really being told about, and things what we voted for on the Eighth Amendment was totally different to what we have today, but that's to go down. I think, and I would call on the boys, that any party member that feels strong enough against what their leader was, resign from the party.
No, because you see, you can make far more change from within the party than from outside. No. And I'll quote a random TD who made such a stand and became a political non-entity.
It's very easy for me to say that I don't agree with Micheál Martin I'm a TD for Fianna Fáil. I don't really agree with Micheál Martin, but I do agree with Micheál Martin, but I'm voting against him here and I'm voting against him here. Make real change. And I would actually
say, is that
say
not democracy within a party though? Because the party gave the TDs the option for a vote of conscience.
They give them a free, yes, they give them a free vote, but obviously the votes work out. I bet you they don't get a free vote on the diesel when they're going to put the diesel up 32 cents or the petrol up 32 cents. They won't get a free vote on that, so they won't. And I can bet, I'll bet you a gallon of petrol on that one.
I couldn't afford that bet.
But what I'm saying is that we should have, when it's come down to the stage now that we're talking about democracy within a party, there's the cabinet table, they decide, it goes out, and the backbenchers vote along with it, which Micheál Martin will be in January, a backbencher. So I think that what they should do, if you feel strong enough about something, go and do something about it. Right. And if it be so be it, it'd be a general election, so be it.
Now, Dakota, obviously I phrased this question discussing, you know, sort of maybe a bit of pushback from within the government parties, but obviously it'd be impossible for me to ignore the fact that it was your party who actually brought this motion forward, this change forward, and it was off the back of some commissioned advice from an NGO, I think, formed the basis of this. Do you think your party's in touch with Ireland in moving this proposed change to legislation?
Yeah, so in terms of the 3-day wait, I do think we are in touch with the people of Ireland, because when you look at who voted for repeal, it was overwhelming. Now, obviously, you break that down into constituencies and whatnot, but when you look at the whole picture, we did vote for repeal, and there was people had issues with the 3-day wait.
But for some people, for many people, it was the 3-day rate. It was the 3-day wait and an abortion being, you know, rare is why they maybe struggled with their conscience and voted in favour of it. And now what we're seeing is, you know, 10,000 plus abortions a year and the 3-day rule being scrapped. So it's a very different system to what people voted for. They certainly didn't vote for it to be tinkered with. I don't think the majority did.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe they didn't. But I do think when the evidence is out there from the NGOs and whatnot that we should be scrapping the 3-day wait, I don't think it provides any reassurance or any good, because it's not stopping anybody from having a 3-day wait. It's just taking away the legality of having to have the 3-day wait. So, I mean, if a doctor still wants to make that person wait, like, you probably will end up waiting whenever you're trying to get a GP appointment if you wanted to take the time. So, I mean,
yeah, but that first meeting with the GP could be talked to discuss out the options. It could be to sort of say, you know, I mean, because we do have thousands of women since 2019 who they may not have turned up again without the 3-D wait. I do accept that, but we had a lot of women that turned up and never went back. They never went back for the second appointment at all.
Yeah, and but the thing with that is we don't have the data on what they did do, so we don't know what.
But then
actually
we shouldn't surely be making such big decisions in the absence of having this data.
Good.
Well, I think we can see that it's something that's not working, is having that 3-day wait. And I don't see why we need to have a 3-day wait. I really don't. And I probably will get prosecuted for that.
No, it's your opinion. It's your opinion. And that's why I've asked you. And
yeah.
we all have different opinions. And it's obviously the view of the party. What will be interesting is to see if we eliminate the 3-day wait, does the number of abortions go from 10, 11,000 to 14, 15,000, 16,000? Would that be a good thing? Would that be a good consequence of getting rid of the 3-day wait?
Yeah, I think it possibly could be, because there's women that might be even travelling to England still to get the abortion if they need to, you know, and we should be providing that healthcare here in Ireland, because it is healthcare at the end of the day.
Okay, what do you think, Joe? Now, I mean, obviously the people had their say, abortion was legalised, you know, that is not going to change anytime soon. What we're talking about here, I suppose, is the political... the political decision to get rid of this 3-day wait versus what some within government or government parties and maybe some out there in the public feel. What's your view?
Well, look, I don't want to attack you personally, Dakota, but there's a number of things that you said there that are totally ridiculous. Calling abortion healthcare, when you're killing something, it's not healthcare.
But we did. I understand where you're coming from, and I'm not being defensive. But
I understand
but people
that
people voted to legalise abortion based on it being healthcare for women.
Yeah, but based on being safe, rare and legal. And it has not been safe, rare and legal, in the sense that it's been 11,000 abortions last year alone. That wasn't what people voted for. And now they got, not only did they get the abortion through, now they have moved it to being the most liberal abortion system in Europe and possibly the world. I wonder if people were faced with what Dakota is suggesting that Sinn Féin did, people were faced with that referendum today, that abortion on demand right up to birth, I would imagine that it would not have gone through. And again, she mentions about NGOs. NGOs, non-government agencies, suggested this absolutely because they're paid by the government. They're handmade off the government.
I don't want to sound like I'm being argumentative, but in Donegal is full of NGOs. NGOs has become a bad word. There are fantastic organisations that we engage with absolutely every single day that are non-government organisations. I think Donegal Down Syndrome is one, for an example, and there are others. So, you know...
But there's,
NGOs has become almost like an insult for faceless people to do the government's work for money.
There are absolutely brilliant NGOs, but there's a lot of NGOs working for the government at the government's behest. We saw that, for example, Greg, when I was on your radio show with the removal of the word family and mother for the referendum. It was the NGOs that were paid that I was debating against. I'm not paid, but they were paid by the government to be the spokesperson for the government. NGOs. And this is what we face. It's an ordinary man and woman in the street who tax these NGOs to tell us what we don't want to hear.
Yeah, but you're coming from this as a position of someone who will never get pregnant. You'll never be raped and get pregnant. You will never have to consider whether you have the financial resources to give birth to a child. You're not going to be compelled to carry a child for 9 months and then birth it and care for it for the rest of your life. You know, you won't be told that there could be, you know, question marks over the baby's health, anything. You will never have to experience that. So isn't it very easy for you to take this solely moral stance? Because, right, your very first comment was to eliminate the possibility that this could be healthcare. You just swept not that health aside to begin with. But it's not healthcare because it's never going to be healthcare for you.
It's absolutely. And why not call it what it is? It's the ending of a life. But just regarding the thing that I'm never going to be pregnant, etc. I'm a father of 5 children. I have responsibilities for those children. I have duties to educate them, to rear them, to bring them up into honourable men and women or whatever it is. I have responsibilities as well. Mm. And it's not as if my wife got pregnant and I walked away.
That happens an awful lot.
I know, but it may well be, and maybe there we need to look at responsibility and men stepping up to the plate. Mm. Maybe that's a different debate. But look, the thing that I have the problem with is taking away the 3-day waiting list or waiting for abortion. And Sinn Féin are going to propose in the next government assisted suicide. And again, are you going to walk in off the hospital, see an old person, say, you know what, you want to commit to assisted suicide, we'll kill you off here now, no waiting period, away we go. At what stage do we put dignity and value on human life?
I certainly wouldn't put it on Sinn Féin because the entire Dáil passed this. Obviously, five or six of eight. Well, the debate from assisted dying is it's going to happen whoever's in government, I would say. But I take your point. Nicholas, do you want to add anything just before the break and we'll move on?
No, I just say that if the same referendum was put in front of the people now, I think I do honestly believe there would be a different vote on it. You know, the abortion was taken in for a few specific reasons, but it's just kind of more or less
it would be very interesting to see how that vote might go. But that vote has happened, you see, and if you go back to 1970 or 1950 and 1930, this is about what happens after the fact. Dakota, do you want to add anything? I understand it's sort of 3 men and a woman. I also understand you're well capable of looking after yourself, but this primarily is, in your view, a woman's health issue. I understand it's not a shout I'm ever going to have to make, so I put a lot of weight into what you would have to say and other women might have to say. But you think it's the right move, and you think the majority of people would be in favour of such a move.
Yeah, I do. And I just want to clarify, I'm not in favor of it up to birth either. Definitely not. There has to be limits. But yeah, I do think it is healthcare, definitely, because when, like, we've seen lots of cases, you know, Savita was a very popular one at the time from Galway, I think, about how she lost her life then and everything. You know, if she had that healthcare in place, she could have had a very different
I
outcome. And
suppose really for people to go to, it's waiting the population decline in this country, which actually follows almost exactly the line of abortions. It's waiting that terrible tragic case where she should have got the healthcare that she should have received versus, you know, 11,000 babies that will not be born. A quarter of those most likely would end in miscarriage anyway, sadly, because of the statistics. But my point being, you know, it still is, but people look at that figure versus that horrendous case you talk of, and it doesn't seem equitable.
Okay, yeah. Well, no, I do think, like, you know, there's so much to it. Like, the rapes and everything is, like, there's just so much to it. I think women should just have their choice if they want to have a child or not.
Do you think we need to also have an honest conversation and say, for some, it will be, oh my word, I'm pregnant, I don't want a baby, I'm going to have an abortion, and then I'll go out on Friday night and life goes on as if it wasn't really a baby or never going to be a baby? Like, that has to be what's happening to some extent as well. And we just have to say, well, we have to accept that, right?
Yeah,
We can't
I think
pretend
that
we
is
can't pretend
happening.
it's 11,000 rapes or incests or fatal fetal abnormalities or whatever. I mean, we have to accept that this clearly, obviously, is being used as a form of, you know, post-fertilization contraception.
I would agree that it is being used that kind of way, but I wouldn't say it's intentionally being used. You know, I don't think women are getting pregnant and then purposely going and getting abortions
No, of
just
course not. Why
because
would anyone
they
put
did.
themselves through that?
No,
Yeah, of course.
I don't think that narrative is true at all, but I don't think people are getting multiple abortions either. I think people are smarter than that. I think accidents can happen. And I think in this society, it is very hard to have a child. The costs, you know, even getting a mortgage when you have children and you're not married and everything, like it does turn you down for mortgages. People come to me all the time, they're saying, I have too many kids, can't get a mortgage. You know, if people aren't at that stage in their life where they're ready to have kids, I think they should have that choice.
I'll give one last word for you, Dr. Kelly, because you seem exacerbated there.
No, I agree with Dakota, and I think she's hit the nail on the head. And for a young woman to say it, I would totally agree with her. And I'm maybe have a rearing a family. She's at maybe at the other end, maybe trying to build a house and maybe start out. You know, it is very expensive to have children today, and that's 100% true. So why don't we have a policy like they have in Hungary, where a mother, if she has one child, two child, three children, it goes along, she pays no tax for the rest of her life if she has three children. Let's support women. Let's bring in policies that actually truly
But you
help women
see, that
rather
doesn't
than just giving
necessarily.
them.
But you see, to some extent, that I would say in terms of women's rights, that would be a step backwards, because what you're saying effectively is you present a woman with a choice, you know, better yourself, have your career, you know, try and get to the top of a company, you know, be what others want to be, or actually don't pay tax and stay at home and have three kids. Do you know?
No,
And next thing you know,
what
we
you
start
say.
judging women on what path they choose, and there's some sort of a, you know, well, you're allowing us to die because you're not having enough babies. You know what I'm on
Oh,
about? Like, it's complicated.
I can understand that, but the idea behind that is to support family. It's not necessarily about anything else in sense of putting women down. It's about supporting families and making them financially viable. And that's back to Dakota, the cost of building a house, the cost of healthcare, the cost of everything. It is almost impossible to have children. And our government policies, just one example, if you have a big family and you need to have a car, you need a bigger car. There's a bigger tax. There's a bigger emissions tax. There's a bigger tax. You can't get a car over 50,000 electric car because there's a higher tax rate on it. Why not support families and say, okay,
Okay.
if you have a family of five, you will get a tax reduction in your car. Let's have policies that support
Right,
families and
but
support
like,
birth
that's never
rather
going to
than.
happen, because let's say someone like Dakota, and Dakota, jump in here and speak for yourself here, but I'm sort of quoting some of the things you've talked about in the past, right? The cost of childcare, the cost of getting yourself and your children around, the inability to get a mortgage, the absolute huge cost of rent, council meetings that are not designed to accommodate someone with a young family, expecting people to sit in meetings all night. I'm not sure if there's any childcare facilities on site at Donegal County Council, for an example. And on it goes. Dakota, I mean, you know, the world is stacked against, you know, maybe someone like yourself or your peers. To this notion then that we could introduce a whole new range of measures to make it far more easy to have a huge family. I mean, if I were you, you know, or anyone, for example, a younger person trying to move forward in life, knowing that you have to work, knowing that it's tough to get a mortgage, I wouldn't have any faith in the powers that be in introducing some of the stuff Dr. Joe Kelly's talking about. What's your feelings, though?
Yeah, no, I don't think I would have much faith either. I think, like, as you say, like,
I mean, I don't mean it funny. Even Sinn Féin couldn't promise that.
Fair enough. No, like, women's rights have come a long way, like, and a lot of women, like, they do see their career as something very, very important. Like, they see themselves on par with who their man or whoever to bring home the money, essentially. They do see that now, like it was before we didn't see that. So, I mean, why a woman should have to give up all that for children and just to have an easier life with the children as such, it just shouldn't be in place. We should have them supports, you know, childcare, everything like that should be.
Okay, we're going to move on. This is a very difficult space to talk about, and I really appreciate all of you getting involved in that conversation because it's so emotive. And, you know, like, your position on something, even though it could be moderate or not, can be repurposed by other people to try and make out you were saying something you weren't. But listen, it was respectful, and it's a tough subject, and I appreciate you participating in it. Lots and lots of you texting in, as you can imagine. And I'll catch up on those as the hour progresses or into the next hour. Now, the Oireachtas Committee concluded this week that criminalising people for personal drug use has completely failed to reduce harm. From a local perspective here in Donegal, would decriminalisation free up vital Garda resources to target major dealers, or would it just send the wrong message to young people? What's your views on this, Nicholas Crossan?
Well, first of all, I think that the drugs are ubiquitous, and I have sympathy for addicts. There's no two ways about it. I have to start off by stating that, Greg. But I would be totally against legalising the drugs, carrying drugs around for personal use. I had maybe in Dublin on Wednesday, and I was standing, I was out walking the dog, and this guy came down with a joint. I'm not joking, not that I've seen many joints, but there was a joint, it must have been about 8 inches long, walking down the street, it wasn't lit, but he was going, and I'm saying to him, what kind of projection is that for children to be seeing somebody able to shoot up on the street for personal use or use weed or whatever the case may be? A simple thing. In Buncrana, 15, 20 years ago, we banned drinking on street because it was giving a poor reflection on the town. The people standing on the street corners with bottles or cans of beer. Would it free up Garda resources? Not at all.
But it would, if you make it illegal, it would still be an offence to import, manufacture, grow, distribute or sell drugs. But what it would mean, though, if you were caught with a small amount of drugs and it was deemed to be for personal use, an individual would no longer face criminal prosecution. So there would be a mechanism to give them a warning. It wouldn't be a pat on the back or give us a tug. They would, you know what I mean? It's not necessarily green light, but what it does is it means they're not tying up the courts, they're not tying up Garda time, and it means the guards can focus on the ports and the airports and try and stop this stuff coming in the first place.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying on that, Greg, but I mean, to legalise people that can walk around, what happens to the poor young lads in Dublin who are out selling, pushing drugs online? So they can carry a small amount. They've got electric scooters, they can nip back and forward, and at any one time they've got just personal use for themselves if they were caught by the guards.
I think the question is, though, Nicholas, what we're doing currently isn't working.
No.
Right? So I think we all agree with that. You know the old adage, it's easier to get Coke than a pizza in Donegal. So what we're doing currently isn't working. So do we not repurpose our resources, be more focused on the health side of it, and try something different? And if it means there's an avalanche of drug use, well, then we can say we tried and failed.
What we're trying to do is we're trying to catch sardines when we should be looking for the salmon.
Exactly. So we send the fishermen after the salmon and leave the sardines alone.
The big guys is the boys that has to be tackled. I mean, the boys that are bringing in the hundreds of kilos of drugs onto Ireland, that's the guys that you want to be hitting. Not the poor guy that's out, the young lad that's forced into it on the street in Dublin because he can buy himself a nice...
Well, Nicholas Sokola says, Nicholas is on about Dublin, but in Letterkenny last weekend I was stuck in traffic and there was a man smoking weed beside my car and it came through the aircon. My car stank for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Thank God I didn't have my baby.
But I did say that drugs are ubiquitous. They're on every boreen and every townland in Donegal. I agree 100%. They're in Buncrana, they're in Letterkenny, they're in Bunbeg, they're everywhere. What you do is put the extra pressure on at the top level. You cut off the supply is what we have to do because there's no point in starting at the bottom. It has to be at top down.
Top down, of course. Dr. Kelly, what do you think? Because as I said to Nicholas, I think we can concede that what we're... Are you frozen, Joe, or is that just your expression? Are you there, Joe? Right, okay, he looks quite perplexed there.
Oh, he's back. He's back.
Right.
It was an amazement.
Nicholas has made sense. Dr. Kelly, I mean, obviously the position we're being in that I think we can concede that what we're doing is not really working very well. But what's your views on these discussions at the moment?
Well, just from the outset, look, I would be very uncomfortable with legalising drugs, but this isn't what is in question here. And I think you've made it very a very good point. It's about decriminalising for personal use. That's not legalising drugs. It's decriminalising it. So in the sense, when somebody's caught with drugs in a personal use capacity, they go through the court system, Gardaí, legalities, prisons, etc., etc. The question is, do we move this away from that into the health department, where if somebody is caught, rather than giving them a criminal record that will go down on their passports if they ever want to go abroad, there's a whole impact of that, particularly on young people that would be maybe, caught using drugs or whatever else. There's a long-term impact for them. Is that the way to go? Or should we be trying to bring it into the healthcare system and say, look, it's like a speeding fine. You'll still get fined. You'll still get a punishment of some sort, but it'll not be a criminal punishment.
Or you could be referred to something. Okay.
But that's going to take a lot of money and a lot of resources. And on an already stressed healthcare system, it will mean that it'll have to bring a lot of money and a lot of resources. Now, where this has happened already is in Portugal, where it has shown it has been very, very positive. It has reduced the number of overdose deaths. It has reduced HIV spread. And it actually has brought more people to addiction counselling. However, having said that, we go across to Canada and British Columbia. They decriminalised drugs for personal use. And after 3 years, this back in June, I think, there of this year, they had to get rid of that law that they brought in. It didn't work. It actually created more problems. It exasperated the problem.
That's how you do it.
And I don't trust our government to do that, number one. And number two is, if you decriminalise it, not legalise it, decriminalise it, it's a wee bit like the abortion. We take an inch and eventually over time it becomes a yard. And therefore I go back to what Nicholas is saying about, the problem isn't the person on the ground that is consuming these drugs. To some degree, they're damaging their own health. They're putting stress on the healthcare system. But the big problem is the criminals that are supplying these drugs. And if we decriminalise drugs, then what we're saying is we're supporting the criminal element that's supplying them, that are creating havoc on our families and our communities. Yeah. And that's the question I would have. Look, are we then saying it's okay for these criminals higher up that people can have personal drugs on them?
But, I mean, look at it. It's 30 years since Veronica Guerin was murdered. And there was a massive push at that time to try and crack down on the importation, distribution of drugs, organised crime. And great measures were put in place, but actually, really, we're no further on in relation to that. So I would argue maybe this is more of an example of, we're doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. It's whether or not decriminalisation has any positive impact in relation to this.
The thing that I've worked in Coolmine Drug Centre, I've been to prisons, I've done pastoral work with that over my life, and I've been with, when I was much younger, young men that had murdered people because of drug overdose, and those young men were no different to me, other than that the social environment they came out of and the drug addiction they had, they were decent people.
Dakota, so, what's your view? Sorry, Joe, I want to bring Dakota in here as well. What's your view on this? It's tricky. It's another tricky subject, this one, because in the absence of really knowing all the potential outcomes, it's kind of a wing and a prayer as if it's whether or not it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think it is a bit of a trial and error with this. But I think what's significant about what the Joint Committee has published is that it is a completely cross-party document. So it has got all support of everyone that was on the committee. You know, when it's presented to the minister now, and it's up to her to have a look at it, and hopefully she will very soon. But I would be in support of what's being proposed. I have looked at the Portuguese model and seen how well that has worked. And look, it's trial and error. It might work here, it might not. But I do think if we want to be serious about a health-led approach to drugs and actually tackling addiction and everything, you do need to take that stigma away from that person.
My concern is that, so, you know, I've got two lads in their early 20s. It's very clear at the moment that, you know, if don't take drugs, you know the message, and if you're caught with drugs, you could stop, you maybe you couldn't go to America or travel the world or what have you. I'm concerned, I don't think they're going to get on this route, fingers crossed, don't get me wrong, Dakota, but my concern is if you remove that for the next generation, does it feel like, well, I can try it, and if a guard stops me, I get a fine, but it's grand.
That's my only concern with it. I don't know if that's the mentality that anybody would have, really, because I think drugs, they're absolutely everywhere without a doubt, but it is a big decision. Now, there is a lot of peer pressure and stuff, and there probably is that bit of rebellion too, where they kind of feel, oh, this is, you know, it's illegal, blah, blah. Same with drinking, people drinking when they're under 18, you know. But like the thing is, you aren't legalising it, as Joe said. So, you know, if you're out in the street using, that's not legal. Like, you know, you will be prosecuted for that. It's just having it on your person is the decriminalisation bit, which is important to note, because like, I think we do need to be tackling the higher up guys. Like, I think drugs are absolutely, the way they've taken over every single community is absolutely shocking, and you would be surprised the amount of people that are using drugs that you wouldn't believe. It's absolutely
and
crazy.
You'd also be surprised the amount of criminal damage incidences that the Gardaí are investigating that perhaps might be related to, you know, recovery of funds or whatever it might be. It is happening in every part of the county. Dakota, Councillor McManaman, thank you so much for joining us. It's been lovely having you on the programme.
Thank you.
Look after yourself. Have a great weekend. Dr. Joe Kelly, Majin Wai, Agus Gurumaigat, Slán.
Slangram, I
can try my best here, and you're not helping me out. All right, good luck. And Councillor Nicholas Cross, and you're only getting 2/3 of your wages because of your late arrival.
That's okay. That's, somebody that asked me, Greg, I'll just say a word. Somebody
What's 2/3 of nothing?
I heard you on the radio last 4 or 5 weeks ago, and he says, "Where do you get paid for going on?" I says, "Listen, Italian radio, and they're only getting a small sponsorship from the government." I said, they should be getting far more for the good job that they're carrying out. And I said, no, I don't do it. And I enjoy Greg's show, and I enjoy talking to the public.
Hey, if you knew the circles, the hoops that you have to jump through to get any little bit, it would blow your head off. Listen, good stuff. Don't forget, listen to the podcast. Dinny McGinley.
Thanks, Greg.
Dinny McGinley's a guest this week. You'll enjoy that. It's on the
podcast.
Thanks,
I will. Right,
good
luck
to you. Bye. Did you see any of the golf ball almost sized hailstones? There was a threat of that as well, but I didn't see any fall. We just had very heavy rain. Didn't see any of the hailstones that may have fallen. Let me see. What about everybody's safety on the roads? If drivers of oncoming traffic can now legally be high, well, you can't legally be high. It's actually having on your possession. But they go on to say, what's left by for us but to get out of here. We need to focus our whole society upon stopping drugs taking root and branch. That comes in from Brian. Brian, I've watched as the figures for drug driving have overtaken drink driving by some degree, it has to be said. And decriminalising drugs doesn't make it legal to drive high. But I understand that you all might be saying that it could be a slippery slope. And obviously, that's a valid point of view. I never saw the attraction to drugs. Why do people do that? How can we even be thinking about decriminalisation? I've never drank or smoked because my body didn't need it at all. It's promoting them. It's promoting drugs. And other decriminalising and legalising are the same thing, in my view. I thought Joe was all about family. He is, and sometimes some decisions are made with that in mind. Two young Australians, only 20 minutes in Dublin City, offered cocaine by three different dealers at a bus stop. Laws, but no enforcement. What a welcome to Ireland. Indeed. I don't know if it's how I look, but wherever I go, I'm always offered drugs. I haven't been away for quite some time, except we had a lovely wee break in Lanzarote, and I was offered drugs every turnaround. And in Portugal, after they were decriminalised for possession, still on the QT, people going, you know, the way they sort of go with their, or so whether you smoke or snort, I don't know what the crack is, but anyway, was still being offered drugs, even though they have been decriminalised for personal possession. Dr. Joe is correct. None of what we witnessed last night was anything to do with climate change. Now, I never suggested that for a moment, by the way. But rather, it was a warning from God on how we've become an immoral country, no longer one of saints and scholars. Joe Kelly is a teacher and educator. Does he not believe his colleagues, the science teachers, who all agree on the cause of climate change? And it has to be said, you can always quote someone who looks at science in a different way. The overwhelming majority of scientists, now these are the people, the very same people we trust in many different other areas of life, the overwhelming majority of scientists believe in climate change and our influence on it. That is just an absolute fact. There are always outliers. You know, there are always outliers and people who interpret data differently and say different things, but the absolute majority of scientists who've spent their whole lives researching this type of stuff are of the view that we are on the brink, potentially, of making much of this world unlivable or the life for many very difficult. They are absolutely convinced. But regular Joes and Josephines, not so much. Right, that's a coincidence, by the way, that Joe's name is Joe, if you know what I mean. On the issue of roads, lots of you messaging in, actually. As I said earlier on, I like these flashing lights with the speed on them. A caller, I think, agrees. Daniel texts in, Greg, flashing speed signs on Leck Road above a creche, very effective, several down the country, but not many in Donegal. And what people have come to do in communities now is actually purchase themselves. I was chatting to a lady from, Brooklis, wasn't it Brooklis? And she was talking that they actually got a price for them, for the community to pay for them themselves, $7,000, which sounds like a lot, but I suppose if a community come together. Spain has flashing triangles and flashing arrows at all junctions, which gives you plenty of warning that junctions are ahead. A caller says they contacted the council about that stop sign that we mentioned before 10, around 6 weeks ago. The road in question has recently been resurfaced, but the caller has not yet received a response from the council. This comment come from another caller. So Gary contacted us initially about this. This other caller says they reported the stop sign in Muff. So what I would impress on, and the councillor, excellent, once they're fully aware of something, is that maybe someone in the road section can get out there and get a stop sign. Because we did have a wee warning. A visitor to the area missed the junction and nearly had a bit of a crash, right? So we need to get that stop sign up. It's a simple enough thing, and I'm sure they'll be on top of that. On the issue of tax, this country is incredibly greedy from a tax point of view. A friend of mine lives in Texas, and there's no income tax there. This government is phenomenal at creating tax and then just throwing it away on unsupervised projects. They're currently trying to charge me LPT for two properties, one of which is a phantom dreamed up by them, and I get zero benefit from LPT. Anyway, rant over. The battle continues, they say. I wonder if they are attributing a air code to you or something along those lines. It's raining here in Brooklis at the moment. Timestamp 10 to 10. There you go. And I'll tell you, I'm looking out the window here at the mountaintop and it doesn't look like rain is an awful long way away. The difference in price in heating oil in Northern Ireland and the Republic, 1,000 litres is now 1,100 to 1,200 euro in the Republic. The same heating oil is 805 euro in Northern Ireland. That's nearly a 33% increase tax. is the big issue there, no doubt about it. Just before we go to our next caller, a very happy birthday to my sister Margaret Carey Maharorty, with lots of love and best wishes from Rosemary and Charlie in Maharorty in Creasla. They'd like to request a good jolly song and send their love. Well, we'll get a good jolly song on for you on another programme. I never had the time, and I certainly don't have the time now, unfortunately, to play music. Paul Finucane has been writing to public representatives with concerns about vacant properties in Carndonagh. Paul, paint the picture for those who aren't aware.
Yeah, good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me on. So I'm sure anybody who goes through Cairn, if you go through Cairn up to Quigley's Point, you'll notice the estate on the right-hand side. That's been completed for, I think it's over 2 years. I remember an article in one of the local newspapers in January 25 announcing that it was soon to be handed over, I think, to the council. Mm-hmm. So it's been empty since then, and it's been sitting there derelict. And as you and your listeners well know, Greg, the situation that the entire country is in, but particularly in Israel and the surrounding areas, the pressure for housing is off the charts. My understanding was that these were supposed to be social houses, or a portion of them anyway, a good portion. And the developer was building for Donegal County Council. And the local stories or the rumours, I won't get into them, but of what happened, and I'm not sure.
Just in relation to what's on the record, and it's not unique to Carndonagh, we've seen it elsewhere. And what has happened, and I presume it's the situation here, is that the council agrees with the developer to purchase the houses for a certain price. Obviously, there's been inflation in terms of, you know, the cost of building houses and what have you. They go back to the council and they say, look, we need such and such for these houses. And the council, looking after public money, says, well, we can't justify that. And I think there's been coverage in the past of housing bodies looking at purchasing these houses to get them into full use. It's a tricky one, Paul, because, you know, obviously the council had a deal in place to buy these houses, but they can't be signing blank checks either, you know, if developers come in and say, now we absolutely want such and such amount of money.
Yeah, absolutely they can't. However, what has the cost been to the state since, with families in temporary accommodation?
Yeah,
there's a huge cost
you.
There, right? Mm. Huge cost. So are they cutting off their nose to spite their face? Either way, whatever the ramifications are or whatever's going on behind the scenes, there are families. I quoted some figures there in the letter. There are roughly over 400 families waiting on the housing list in Donegal. Let's just say there's 10 or 20 in a zone, it's probably higher. Those children in temporary accommodation don't care what the legal stuff behind the scenes is. They just want a home, and their parents want their children to have a home. So somebody needs to step in at some stage and sort it out. Now, my understanding is Martin McDermott is working hard behind the scenes, and something may be about to come over the line. But I think we've heard that before as well, so fingers crossed it will. But having those houses sitting there is criminal at this stage.
Yeah, okay. Let's remind ourselves of some of the coverage we've done on it. And the last time this has been reported really in the news anywhere that I can find is May 2024. We interviewed local councillor Albert Doherty on the issue. Let's have a little listen to what he said at that time.
58 housing units were to be turnkey social housing for the council, and that remains a priority for myself as a councillor to see that occur. However, while Donegal County Council state that they retain an interest, this hasn't been matched by any action or improvement in the standoff. And I believe this matter involves and demands that DCC, the developer, and Minister Darrell Breen, that they get into a room, explore, and dissolve any issues that are preventing progress with this development.
Yeah, that was 2024, and we're no further on, Paul. Darrell O'Brien, no longer the housing minister, but still these houses now complete, lie vacant. But you say there's some indication there could be a development. What we'll do, though, is chase up with Councillor McDermott, chase up with the local authority, and see where this sits right now, Paul.
Yeah, so Greg, like, hopefully there will be a resolution to it, but like, there's, you know, that's 2024, I think you said. That takes an awful long
May
time.
May 2024. Over 2 years. Over 2 years, that is.
Yeah, as Albert said there, this is a job for a minister to step in and say, lads, cop yourselves on, sort this out, get into a room and sort it some way, or put it through some form of arbitration and have an escrow account where money is sitting, and after the arbitration it gets dealt with, but get people into those houses and get families out of temporary accommodation.
Okay. Funny, going back to that time, the approved housing body there was news that they had approved a sum which was greater than that the council were prepared to pay. Don't know what happened there, but we'll chase it up, Paul. Thanks for bringing it back across the desk.
Thanks,
and it gives us an opportunity to look back into it, because as you say, it's actually insult to injury having these beautiful properties lying there in a housing crisis, and a housing crisis particularly in Inishowen, because there's so much pressure on housing there for factors that we all know about. Thanks, Paul.
Absolutely. Cheers, Greg.
Look after yourself. Really pleased to welcome into studio author Paul Charles. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping?
I'm good, great. Thanks a million for inviting me.
No, it's great to have you in. And what an amazing life you lead, Paul, between, you know, being a best-selling author and also working some of the great and the good, and maybe some not so great and good in the world of entertainment. Do you feel blessed?
No, totally. Every day. I mean, actually, my wife Catherine keeps saying it. You know, you really have been lucky to work in the golden age of music, and it really is. I mean, you go and see the Hothouse Flowers, and they're still performing like they're teenagers, doing great. You know, Christine, unbelievable to be allowed to go to all of these gigs non-stop and see all these wonderful artists. It's like being a kid in a sweetie shop.
As an artist yourself, you know, obviously your relationship with a lot of the musicians that you work with and others is business, but do you soak up inspiration or what have you from the artists that you work with?
Yeah, I think you do. I mean, I think we all absorb everything that's going on around us.
Clever people do.
Yeah, yeah. And a couple of them that my novels have been kind of set using either the background of the music business or fictitious musicians or whatever it is. And it's all kind of, I think it's that thing about, you know, I mean, I kind of, my books, I treat my books like I'm a camera and I'm going into these scenes and I'm kind of, you know, recording what I see and then kind of putting it all into a story.
Yeah.
As in, you know, I mean, and the other main thing of the books is I like to keep them really, really real. I like to, you know, my biggest nightmare would be somebody reading the book and going like, Paul, for heaven's sake, that would just never have been possible. I cannot make sure it's like real and I have that file of it.
So as you... sort of visualize what you are to create, if I could phrase it like that, is that at a typewriter in inverted commas, or would you sort of be constantly thinking, get a good frame of where you want to go, and then sit down and output?
You know, the funny thing about the books that I find is that when I start the book, I haven't a clue who committed the crime.
Okay.
And I think it's kind of, I don't think I'm clever enough that I did know that I could hide it or whatever. And I try and create a situation whereby the reader, the writer and the detective are all in the one shoes.
Yeah.
And we're all going through it at the same time and all discovering all of this stuff.
It's quite interesting because, you know, someone could be halfway through your book and say, I know how this is going to end. But the truth is we know they'd actually be guessing because the author at that time may well have not known how it was
exactly,
going to end.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
I'm not a huge reader, Paul, so I'm going to put my cards on the table. Are you a fan of the red herring in storytelling?
Not as a tactic.
Mm.
Like in real life, there are red herrings.
Of course.
So you kind of, you deal with that. It's the same with the other thing about detective fiction. Most of detective fiction, the main characters do not have a love life, you know, and all of us deal with our love lives on a daily basis, no matter what age we are, you know, wanting, feeling loved, feeling not feeling loved, all this thing, all kind of go to create this character that makes them different, that makes them individual.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, from my point of view, makes them real on the page, you know, so that people kind of can embrace. Because I always thought that a big part of the success of a book is the reader's imagination, mm-hmm. is the reader's interpretation of what you're doing. Because you can describe a scene or a woman or a man, and that's really down to the human, how they interpret that.
Well, you supply the paintbrush and the canvas and the paint. It's up to them. Talk to me about your latest work, High Love. You just dropped your glove, a Makuska mystery. So talk to our listeners about this book.
Okay, so it's set in Portrush. As a kid, I used to go to my parents used to take me to Portrush every summer. I've always had a love for it. Even today, every time I come over to Donegal, I'll nip up to the port for a couple of days. There's just something about the city, whatever you want to call it, that's kind of magnetic to me. And again, working back at that theory, I want to keep the stories real. I want to make the locations real. I want to make the characters real. And so that's where the title comes. I wanted the two main people in the book, as in, I call them the visitors, people who are just individuals of the book, you know, Thomas Barry and the High Love You Just Dropped Your Glove Girl. I wanted to find a way how these people could meet, that it would appear to be real, that it would appear to be, it wasn't a story. And there's a lyric on Van Morrison's album, Astral Weeks. Personally, I think it's one of the best albums ever made in the world, where it's you have this scene and Van's saying, hey, love, you forgot your glove. And at the time, which was 1968, those words, that imagery just stuck me, hit me. And they've been there ever since.
You logged it.
Yeah, totally. And it was that thing about, I went into it the way I know. I went into it and I said, well, okay, so now the guy's at a party. He's an Ulster man, so he's kind of quite shy. He's not really forward. He hasn't got the lines for girls. He's dying to find a way to make some kind of connection or to say something to her, and he can't. And then she gets up from her seat and she leaves her glove on the seat, and that allows him to say, you forgot your glove.
Brilliant.
You know, thinking that it's going to go somewhere else. And in that instance, my imagination is that, okay, she come back, got her gloves and walked out of the room and walked out of his life. But in this story, I have these couple that meet on the streets of Portrush late in the year, late at night. And again, he's walking along, Thomas Barry's walking along, and he sees this incredible, beautiful human being, you know, and he's tongue-tied, but he's kind of frozen by it. He kind of go, oh my God, what, you know, and so he feels he has to say something, and then he berates himself, you know, you're going to just say something stupid, just don't say anything at all, just leave the girl alone, whatever, she's with her two mates. And in the last instant, as she's about to pass, she drops her glove, and he was allowed to give his introduction line, hi love, you just dropped your glove. And they met and fell in love and lived a life, and all these years later, he's found dead in Portrush Harbour, and that's when Makuska is brought up from Belfast with his partner O'Carroll to work on the crime. And it turned out that Makuska had been with Barry on the night that he met the High Love You Just Dropped Your Glove Girl.
Wow, brilliant. I love the way you call her. I love that. That's her name. Now, obviously, this follows previous books, so where it's set is locked in. Was there a point where you made a decision that you wanted them to be real, you wanted them to be based here, but you thought about maybe commercial success or accessibility, like you could have written these in Paris or Amsterdam or whatever, right? Now, I'm not saying it affected the popularity in any way, shape or form, but was there an internal or external conversation where you thought, I've got brilliant stories here, I know I can write a really good book, is it the right thing to set it in Northern Ireland or in Portrush or wherever the other books have been set?
Yeah. I basically try and write about what I know.
Yeah, okay.
Where I know. To it. Yeah. But also as well, I try and write stories that I would love to read.
Yeah.
And so for me, you know, a crime, a murder mystery, a good detective set in Portrush would be straight off the counter. I mean, just brilliant, you know. So I've never really had any, you know, I've never really, like a mate of mine, John Connolly, writes the brilliant series set in Boston, and he goes and spends a part of each year living in Boston.
Who's that, sorry?
John Connolly.
Right, and what?
The Dublin writer.
Okay, yes.
Great, his books are all beautiful. I know Portrush very, very well. I've known it through the years, I've known it through the decades, I've lived in Camden Town. since 1968. And so I know Camden really, really well. And then I've spent time in Donegal because my wife's from Letterkenny, Catherine's from Letterkenny. So we spend a lot of time in Remelton. And so that's where the Starrett stories come from. So it's kind of it's really not picking somewhere you think is going to be,
you know,
commercial.
Yeah.
It's picking somewhere you think
that's true.
It's real.
Yeah, and it's true to you.
And you know, you make the story real with the folks.
Now, whilst this new book is out now, there's also a, I don't know how to phrase it, but a rebirth really of all of your work, isn't there? Because you really recently signed a deal that's going to see your back catalogue republished. How exciting is that for you? Because it opens it up, of course, all to a brand new audience.
Yeah, no, totally. And particularly, it's an American-based publisher.
Fantastic.
And so it's kind of, it gets to get all the stories out. So the idea is that, so this book's going out, a Muskie book, there's a Kennedy book coming out later on.
Mm.
And then after that, they're going to start to release in dribs the rest of the books, you know. So this will just be the three detective series. There won't be any of there's Adventures in Wonderland, there's a Shoban book, there's a Middlester, you know, there's a pile of ones, but they're about to put all the series.
Is there a book in you that has to come out, whether it's part of the series or something new or on a different topic? Or?
It's funny, actually, Greg, because I find that ideas for books come along when I least need them or like them.
Mm.
So when you're working on a book, and you're kind of thinking about something and you're writing or whatever, and you kind of think, oh, that might be a good, you know, whatever. And so I've never actually sat down and thought, okay, now I need to come up with some ideas for the book. So there's always kind of, there's always something there. There's always a character.
But it almost sounds like an accident, but of course it's not because, and it really is quite remarkable given the business that you have, but you don't have a mobile phone. And I presume part of that is for clarity, right? So in a way, these ideas coming to you are because you've created this space whereby you have the ability to have space for
it. Yeah, I mean, I personally think that humans need to be disconnected for a part of each day, you know, and I walk a lot. I love walking. And, you know, it's just, again, you know, the next story that I'm starting to think about now, it's, you know, and you don't really work on thinking, okay, now I need to come up with a new book. It's a story's coming along.
Mm.
I found as well that you have to deal with this stuff as it's, you know, otherwise you lose the naturalness of the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
If you kind of write, do a few notes on this and come to it later, you kind of lose the bit of the earthiness of it, you know. So I find that way just to follow the lead of the voice that's in my head.
I'm looking at some of the notes I have here and the blurb from your publisher, and whilst it talks of you being a great author and, of course, a manager, you play music yourself, though, do you?
No, I listen to music, but I write written lyrics.
Right, so you don't perform, per se. Do you read in public at all?
Yes, we do public readings. Okay,
that's maybe what people are referencing here. Because, hi, Greg, please tell Mr. Charles that I had the pleasure of hearing him play in our local in Remelton. Is that you?
Yeah.
And what were you doing?
I was talking about books.
Oh, brilliant! Okay. I thought you were keeping the secret on me. So
please believe me. You do not want me.
I thought I'd try and see. Can I get something out of this?
No, let's spare
the
nation.
So our researchers and your publicists are doing good work. Then they're not omitting anything. What was it like? What is it like working with, just to give listeners an idea, Van Morrison, Christy Moore, Rory Gallagher, Robert Plant. Rory Gallagher, obviously, you know, a huge resurgence and interest in Rory recently in the establishment of the festival in Ballyshannon, etc. I mean, have you a memory of Rory, actually? Might be of interest.
I was Rory's agent for a good while. Yeah, I've been going to see Rory in Portrush, actually, of all places, since I was a teenager, you know, where there was the original band, The Taste. A group of us would go up and see it. And it was just, you know, the thing about Rory that I love the most is that when you go to a Rory Gallagher gig or a Taste gig, whichever, either or both, you come away from that gig as drained as the musicians on stage are. Because he just engages everybody with every note he's playing, with everything he's doing. It's like, it's not like a normal concert. It's like a celebration. He doesn't play to an audience. He plays with an audience, you know. And he's one of the most inspiring musicians and human beings I've ever met in my life.
I must ask about Van Morrison, because he would have a reputation for being a little bit difficult to work with. He's got his own style. I must ask, what was...
Van Morrison's a gentleman. I mean, he really is a gentleman. He's one of the funniest men you'll ever meet off stage, you know. He goes about his work the way he goes about his work. And being an artist, as brilliant as he is, that's the way he wants to do it. Something works. So whatever's working, don't try and change it. You know, I've found him very professional to work with, very, very funny. Nothing but... And again, the same thing is that I was a major, major fan of Van Morrison. And then imagine getting to work with this guy and going to gigs to see him for like 6 or 7 years and being part of the audience to hearing this wonderful sound come. It's just like unbelievable. Yeah. I've been so lucky.
And before we circle back to the book, you know, some of the stuff that you've done and continue to do is very obvious, and some of it not so. And you've been a long-time booker of the acoustic stage at Glastonbury Festival.
Yeah.
Which has made, and you know, made people, really, you know, and helped to sort of craft what people take for granted, sort of, you know, what is popular, what they love, who they go and see. Yeah. Talk to me about that.
Well, actually, funny enough, I was just reading the Errigal Arts Festival magazine, and they've got the Henry Girls playing that. We had them. They were so stunning. I mean, I also saw them at James McDade's Wine Bar as well. You know, I love doing it, and I love doing it because... You get a chance. Obviously, you have to book. People are going to fill the tent, 6,000 capacity in the same outside. So you've got to find a way of mixing both, that you want to introduce beautiful artists, great artists to this audience.
Yeah, but you also have those who are simmering. And that this could be the breakout for them. Exactly. Is there an artist you booked for the acoustic stage that would fit that category, that you saw something there? You know, they have a fan base, but this could be a catalyst to something much greater.
Well, no, we would last. I mean, we had Hosier there before. Yeah, before he was, you know, we'd quite a few people. And again, it's not really, you know, cherry picking, or it's not really kind of having a crystal ball. It's just you kind of hear something, it strikes the chords, and you want to kind of, you know, you put them on. But one of the magic moments I remember of the acoustic stage is one year we booked Art Garfunkel, and he just had that trouble with his voice for a while, and he'd had an operation, and he wasn't very confident about his voice was going to hold. But anyway, he came and he did it, and he topped the bill for us on a Saturday night. And I remember when he got on stage, you could see that he was a wee bit nervous, a wee bit, you know, am I going to get through this? And the voice was holding, and he was good, you know. And then he did the Sound of Silence, you know, and obviously he didn't have Paul Simon there, but he started under the Sound of Silence. And this is like one of the most amazing things I've ever experienced, is the audience with a voice of one joined in and sang Paul Simon's part.
Iconic.
And we're talking about 5,000 people. Now, those people didn't say, okay, we'll go high when he goes low. It just magnetically, all these people made a connection. Mm-hmm. And it was such one of the most beautiful experiences you could imagine. Yeah, yeah.
What a beautiful memory to have been there.
Totally.
And to also have helped facilitate it as well, too, you know. Because I was talking about your influence, and also there's an influence there in, you know, putting this county, a place that you clearly love, not just Portrush, but in other work that you've done, you know, putting this county literally on the map. You know, with different types of stories, which I think is great, you know, because we don't want to be too stereotyped either. So it's some of the work you've done has sort of given a different platform to Donegal as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's the Donegal detective, which is starred, and there's three stories.
If you ever need an actor for him, I could be a middle-aged, balding alcoholic. I just need to up my drinking a bit.
Yeah, get on the Guinness a bit. No, there's hopefully there'll always be a need for them. The thing is about books is that every time an author brings out a new book, you know, no matter who it is, there are conversations start about whether it would go on TV and if it did and whatever. And I've been to the dance a few times, and it's never kind of got to be a, you know, shall I walk you home afterwards? It never got to that stage yet. So it's more that with I just love Donegal. I love Rimmelt, and it's such a, you know, the characters around town.
Rimmelt is something else.
You don't need to invent. Yeah. It's all there. It's all.
I don't want to sound in any way patronising, but you have a fantastic life. Between your own artistic abilities, but also the people you work with. But what seems really nice is you're in the moment and enjoying it. And some people don't have that, and that feels like a blessing.
No, totally, yes. And a blessing is the right word for it.
Okay. Yep. The latest book from Paul Charles, and Portrush, incredibly familiar to pretty much everyone listening. So it's always nice to have a little bit of local interest that an international audience might not get. The latest book is High Love, You Just Dropped Your Glove. It's a McClusker mystery, so if you're familiar with that detective, you'll be chomping at the bit to get a new story. Paul, thank you so much for calling in. Enjoy your stay, enjoy your travels, and we really appreciate your time. It's the usual, isn't it? It's available in all the usual places, as you might expect. We'll link it on our socials as well. Brilliant. Thank you so very much for calling in.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks a lot.
Business Matters is brought to you by Print Supplies Frosses. Fed up waiting days for an engineer to service your printer or photocopier? Tired of running out of ink? Print Supplies keeps your office running smoothly with managed print solutions, local Donegal support and remote monitoring. With 21 years in business, Print Supplies helps save your business time and money. Email sales at printsupplies.ie to find out more.
Chris, are we doing news or just the pod?
We'll start off with the pod.
Right, okay then. So, would you like one subject in this week's pod?
Mm,
what
maybe
about
more?
Two? Should we settle on three?
Let's go for it.
All right, okay. What's on the show this week?
Right, well, first up, I've been speaking with a Donegal Town-based blocklayer, Kieran Cassidy, a native of Pedigo, spent some time in the United States and Australia, back home now, involved in building homes, and he has set up a new online business venture called tradeswap.ie. Now, as the name suggests, it's a platform where people can offer a skill that perhaps they have in exchange for somebody else doing something else for them.
Is it sort of within industry, right? Because I'm, you know, so say a bricklayer and a spark or...
Well, primarily, but it's not going to be restricted to that. So it could even be somebody who's doing child minding.
Okay.
The way the website is set up, you'll put your details on it. Somebody will have a look. If they think, well, I'll be interested in that, let's come together. You will agree amongst yourselves what you're going to do, so he won't be responsible for that. It's a pretty straightforward process, and we have a clip here, and he explains what it's all about.
Basically, it's just a web-based platform where you can log in and swap maybe skills or trades with anybody. I suppose the best way to explain it would be to give you a real-world example. I'm currently doing a self-build in Donegal Town, and as you know, it's expensive nowadays, and it's difficult to get trades. And I had a carpenter in one day pricing work for me, and we got talking, and he was kind of in a similar situation at his own house. He wanted a bit of work done, some block laying, and so we kind of came to the agreement. I told him I would work at his house and do the block laying for him, and he could do the carpentry work at my house, and that I'll basically save us having to come up with the money to pay each other. We just used our time instead of money. And the website did cost me a few quid. I just thought I'd take a shot at it. If it doesn't work out, it is what it is. But down the track, it could be a small subscription. It could be advertising. Priority at the minute is just to get people on there and get them swapping. And it's free to use.
But it's quite interesting, actually. The example he gave was the obvious example. But what I notice that's interesting on the website, the drop-down menu, you could have someone that works in PR or marketing, yeah, right, and could talk, say, I can develop your website and set up your social media, but I need the outside of the house painted. Now, obviously, you have to come up with the value of each service or what have you. So it's not strictly, you know, a carpenter helping out a plumber and vice versa. So if you are, you know, maybe it's designed their logo or whatever it might be, maybe become their PT. I see a health and wellness there. You might say, you know, you do this for me and I'll be 3 months of PT. So it's an interesting idea. Mm. And I'll tell you what it really needs is just to take off.
Exactly.
That
and that's
sense?
Why he's pushing it now. As he says now, he may get a little bit of advertising. He may, down the road, there might be a small subscription, but you're going to pay that if you're getting a return and you feel you're benefiting from it as well. And lots of small subscriptions will add up. The website, it's very easy to navigate, and you can put in things like, the radius. So if you're offering to do bike repairs, obviously you're not going to go down to Kerry or whatever. And he talks about this in the programme as well. So you can put in within 40 kilometres or whatever. Yeah. So,
well done. I hope he it's well works well for him. Check out tradeswap.ie, register an interest. It's early doors, but you never know. And as I say, you do, when you set up something like that, you kind of get it established, get some traffic going, and then you start talking about how it's monetized. But anyway, it's an interesting idea. And it's quite interesting how he said, look, if it works, it works. Or if it doesn't, it is what it is. Small Firms Association Director, you've also been yapping with him.
Yes, indeed. David Broderick, he is Small Firms Association Director. They've just carried out their annual survey and they found that small businesses have seen a 44% cumulative increase in costs. That's on average over the past 3 years. So they are lobbying the government for better treatment for small firms in the next budget. Very much an emphasis on things like energy costs, tax reform, and also they're adamant that there should be no further increase in the minimum wage.
We hear quite a bit from the Donegal Local Development Company, a DLDC. They've published their annual report, which you cover on the podcast stroke programme as well. And it's interesting because it kind of puts a bit of meat on the bones, you know, talking, it gives us an idea of, you know, the output from the input.
Absolutely. I've been speaking with the CEO of the Donegal Local Development Company, Porrick Fingleton. He's been talking about, you know, a lot of people have probably heard of DLDC, but they're not really aware of the support. It's like a helping hand. It's guiding people in the right direction. There's grant money there. There's leader money there. They've been involved with 71 local community groups in the last year. Now, a lot of the things it's not just bricks and mortar type stuff. They can be, these days, a lot of community groups, there's all sorts of rules and regulations and governance. So training people in areas like that. And they actually support 422 people in full-time, part-time and self-employment. So that's significant.
Yeah, indeed. Big money invested too, €3.4 million. You talked about the training, the workshops, the soft skill training, 2,421 people supported. That's actually really quite significant. That's a lot of stuff. Right, there's a Donegal recruitment firm in the news too.
Yes, Niche SSP, that's Specialist Starting Partners. They're based here in the county. They won a regional award for the Northwest at the National Enterprise Awards last week. And this is the fourth consecutive year that a Donegal business has been recognised at the National Enterprise Awards. So that just shows the strength of businesses here. That follows on from the success of Seabound up in Inishowen, Living Green and the Silver Strand Ropeworks.
And finally, Best Kept Business Competition for the Twin Towns. What's this about?
Yes, Bella Buffet and Stranorlar Chamber, they're running a Best Kept Business Competition. Two categories, small and large businesses. The judging will be in August, so it takes into account overall presentation, cleanliness, displays and how well the premises.
Is it in the main street or all of Bella Buffet?
All of Bella
Buffet. It's going to be difficult because, you know, if you're off the main street, you have a bit more scope. And sometimes, if you're on the main street, a lot of what you present is out of your control.
That is true.
I would split that up further. I'd have an off and on main street now.
Well, maybe it will evolve.
Level that blooming playing field.
Good luck to all. And look, it's a great idea, a good initiative. And if a place looks better, everyone wins.
You're all right there. Okay, Chris, the podcast is released when?
It'll be going out just after lunch today.
All right. Check it out on our website, highlandradio.com, but also you can subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify as well, which facilitates a chapter breakdown and transcript as well, which can be beneficial to people out there. And you can listen to it on the radio as well on Sunday, isn't that right?
That's right, after the 6 o'clock news on Sunday.
So if you're we're looking forward to maybe a Donegal game on Sunday, you can comfort yourself instead with Chris and the podcast. Isn't that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Look after you. Are you watching the World Cup?
Absolutely, yeah. Enjoying it very much.
What element of it?
I've watched a lot of the sort of 9 and 11 o'clock games. Stayed up last night to watch the Scotland game.
I was going to stay up to watch it to the end. But when Brazil went 2-0 up, the telly went off. To be truthful. Like I thought maybe Scotland could score with a header early on and it could have made an exciting game as they held out for a draw. No. But Brazil showed their class, didn't they?
Big golf and class there, yeah.
And in the space of 90 minutes, it went from it's coming home to sack the manager.
Well,
do you know who I'm talking about?
Fickle fans.
Is there any teams that you have got an interest in that you really shouldn't have? Do you remember that World Cup where we all sort of took an interest in Cameroon?
Yes.
And then the Ivory Coast because it's our flag reversed.
Well,
is there a...
I suppose Cape Verde have been one of the stories so far, and the fact that there's a Shamrock Rovers link there with one of the players, that gives an added bit of interest to the whole thing. I've enjoyed watching the French. It'll be interesting to see how they...
When we get to the knockouts, it's a lot of games to get rid of 18. How many teams get rid of, anyway, a handful of teams. All right, Chris, thanks so much indeed. Chris's podcast, Highland Radio's podcast, Business Matters, available for you after lunch. Caller says, I've been on to DDC, Donegal County Council, for over 5 years now, reflashing lights at the golf course crossroads. There's always collisions there every year, but might as well be talking to the wind. Again, just in relation to dependent on the road, there can be shared responsibility, or some of it can be outside the responsibility of the council as well. I'm not an apologist for the council. I'm just being realistic. Hi, Greg. This has been a day where there's been a lot of road stuff. And, you know, it's no harm getting it all out there because clearly there's a lot of frustration. Hi, Greg. I very nearly had a serious collision at 8:30 this morning in Kilmacrenan Village, all because of cars going through at around 50 miles per hour. On numerous occasions, your show has identified the dangers. Shame on all who were standing idly by, twiddling their thumbs regarding speed through this village. Of course, shame too on drivers who have no respect for speed limits or road safety in the first place. Thanks, Greg. It's all been said before. I know, but listen, we can't give in. We have to keep talking about it. Kilmacrenan is a particular black spot. We've had a couple of close shaves there. And no disrespect, by the way, if there's a fatality I've missed, but I can only really speak about my more recent knowledge. We've had a couple of really close shaves there where we could easily be talking about a couple of fatals in the last year or so. So it is a... I think the people that live there primarily need something done. I'm a cancer patient who has throat cancer, and hence I have a medical card. And I'm really sorry to hear that, and all the strength to you that you need at this time. But reading on your comment here, as a result of some treatment for the cancer, I have dental issues. I cannot get a dental appointment in the shown area because I'm a medical card holder. Now, because of not being seen, I'm losing my teeth fast. I have no transport either, by the way. Last month, it took me 13 hours to travel to Galway to be seen by a dentist for 20 minutes. I can't do that journey on a regular basis to get dental treatment. It's very unfair on the likes of me that no practice will see dental patients, medical card patients. It should be like the GP situation. There should be government-appointed practices in every area. I get where you're coming from. I feel your frustration. I'll put it out there, by the way, that... there are dentists in Donegal, I know, certainly at a time, were still accepting medical card patients. But if anyone out there can advise this listener that in the shown area, they went to Galway for a 20-minute dental appointment, there must be somewhere more locally than that that will treat this person, so they don't have to travel so much. Released tomorrow, speaking of podcasts, at 11 a.m, the latest Greg Hughes podcast from Highland Radio. Our guest is Dinny McGinley, former TD, who's had a very interesting life and can reflect on time some time ago in West Donegal, his education, how he ended up in politics, some of the more controversial things that happened in terms of politics, candidate selection, and so on and so forth, and what he's doing with his time now. So it's an interesting chat. It's Dinny McGinley on the Greg Hughes podcast, released for you after the 11 o'clock news tomorrow on highlandradio.com, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get those podcasts. We're back live on this show tomorrow morning at 9.